We are very happy to have Bianca Dietrich here from Perimeter Institute, and she will talk about a tensor network description of quantum gravity in three dimensions.
Yeah, let me thank the organizers for organizing this nice conference at a difficult time. So I'm coming from quantum gravity, so I will present things more coming from a quantum gravity perspective and show you how to derive tensor network states from quantum gravity. And then hopefully also tell you how tensor networks can do something for quantum gravity. Of course. So the overview of the talk is that I will have a first part, which will be quite focused on 2 plus 1D quantum gravity. And I will explain how you can interpret that as a tensor network states. And with a precise notion of quantum geometry, I will clarify the role of diffeomorphism symmetry and talk about interesting boundary theories you can get in this case. And there's a couple of papers which are about these boundary theories. And if you don't want to read 50 pages, there's a short summary paper. This one. And if there's time, there's a second part where I will explain how to use tensor network algorithms to explore the phase diagram of quantum gravity. In particular, the aim is to do that in 4 dimensions. So there will be kind of lots of background material, and I couldn't include all possible relevant references, but if you have any questions about these references, you can just contact me. So 3D general relativity is actually a topological field theory. So there are no local degrees of freedom, and solutions are either locally flat if you don't have a cosmological constant or if it's zero, or homogeneously curved. And thanks to that, is actually we can construct a reasonable theory of quantum gravity, so it's already there. And you might already know the theory in some form. So for vanishing cosmological constant and Riemannian signature, the theory is actually given by an SU2 BF theory, so the topological theory known as BF theory. And this BF action actually gives you the Palatini action if you identify B to be with the triads of your quantum gravity theory. So this SU2 BF action is just defines an integral over flat SU2 connections. And if you are doing lattice gauge theory, you actually know that as lattice gauge theory at zero coupling. So a version of the theory was actually already suggested in 1968. So I guess it's the first time a topological field theory has been defined without knowing what a topological field theory is by Ponzano and Reggi. And this model has been made more precise within the loop quantum gravity framework. This model is also equivalent, or BF-SE2 is a series equivalent to Chern-Simons, but actually so Chern-Simons for SE2 cross R3. And so if you're wondering how we can deal with Chern-Simons in a discretization, the reason is it's basically something which is sometimes called a doubled or non-chiral version of Chern-Simons, which comes from really using this SU2 cross R3 and not just SU2 as a structure theory for Chern-Simons. So I will mostly spend my time on this case, or exclusively. You might ask, why is this case of a flat space time interesting for holography? And then in 3D, you know, for if you have asymptotic ADS boundary conditions, that is for negative bound cosmological constant, indeed, we know that you get at the boundary a theory with a conformal symmetry group as figured out by Brown and Anand. But also for asymptotic flat boundary, there is an infinite dimensional symmetry group known as BMS symmetry group, which plays quite an important role. And we will also see that even if you go to finite boundary, there are interesting holographic duals in this case. So we do get interesting symmetries or interesting series even with an infinite dimensional symmetry group at the boundary. So I will spend most time on this flat case because there's certain technologies which are kind of well developed in this case. But in principle, you can also consider de Sitter with a Riemannian signature. And that's kind of the model which is most well known in condensed matter because these define your Satura Viro models for SU2K. That K is related to the cosmological constant. And basically, you might know this model already through the StringNet models. And you can again understand it as a lattice gauge theory with a quantum deformed symmetry group. And again, it's equivalent to Chern-Simons for this double of SU2K. And that's also the equivalence which is most rigorously proven in the mathematical literature. So for lambda smaller equals, for lambda negative, I get ADS space. Again, it's a Satura Viro-like model with Q real. So, which means you have actually, you know, in SU2K, you have finitely many degrees of freedom. So here you have actually an infinite dimensional gauge symmetry. And in general, again, there's also Chern-Simons formulation, which you can go to in a framework called combinatorial quantization. And there's also quite some literature on in a gravitational context. So mostly I will spend my time on the flat case, but you can in principle do things also for negative cosmological constant and the ADS space. There's some technical issues you have to deal with. Even for the flat case, different from what you might be used to this positive cosmological constant and SU2K, the actual symmetry group here is non-compact because the symmetries give you diffeomorphisms, but the gauge fixing is actually very well understood in this case. So let me explain how you get tensor network states out of this framework. And I will first explain that quantum gravity states can be interpreted as tensor network states, but they come also with a precise quantum geometric interpretation. And the choice of tensor network connectivity and bond dimension and basically tensors can be understood as a complete gauge fixing of bulk diffeomorphisms. And that holds in 3D. And so basically we are all degrees of freedom in some sense are gauge, and so you can basically gauge fix all degrees of freedom. So I will basically present you what comes out of this quantum gravity framework. I will not try to motivate much where these things come from, because I rather want to explain how it relates to tensor network states. So we are in 2+1 dimensions, and if you talk about states, so we have, these are defined on a two-dimensional hypersurface. And if you have a boundary, you are down to one dimensions. So the boundary, these boundary states or the states defined via this tensor network will be defined on a one-dimensional, in this case, circles. And we discretize them with, in some way, but for simplicity, I assume we have edges of equal lengths. And to this boundary, what comes out, you have a boundary Hilbert space. And this is basically the spin chain Hilbert space. So you have representation spaces with a fixed spin representation, which I call here J delta. And you have a tensor product over the sites. To each edge here, there's associated site. The spin representation, JFX, is also the bond dimension of these edges to be basically the dimension of this representation space to J plus one. So you have this boundary Hilbert space, and you can define a state in this boundary Hilbert space via a quantum gravity bulk state. And the quantum gravity bulk state is defined by choosing a network. So here I have a three-valent network. We will later generalize that, but for now it's three-valent. And each link of this network is labeled again by a spin representation. And what it represents is actually a spin network basis state. So how does it define you a state in this boundary Hilbert space? It's basically via the usual tensor network contraction. So the vertices of this three-valent network represent you, basically are given by unique, the SU2 invariant tensor, which is unique for a three-valent vertex. So just the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients or Wigner 3J symbol. So you take these SU2 invariant tensors and contract them according to the network connectivity. And again, all these labels, J is a spin representation, just translate into a specific bond dimension. So these SU2 invariant tensors, they can be also nicely represented in a graphical way. And that just uses the construction of a tensor product of higher spin representation as a tensor product of spin 1/2 representation. So here a spin one link can be represented as two strands of spin 1/2. And these vertices in principle just can be constructed out of a sum over permutations. That means permutations here means just braiding these strands. And then there's definite rules how to connect basically inside these vertices the strands with each other. And that gives you really the invariant, the SE2 invariant tensor. And so Penrose, Roger Penrose was the one which is credited with basically inventing these spin networks or this Binor, so-called Binor calculus or diagrammatic calculus, which played a big role in all the other categorical calculi. And so you get a picture which looks very much like the spaghetti picture Jens Eisert was also mentioning. So this defines you the tensor network, and I will now explain a bit that it comes with a precise rigorous quantum geometric interpretation. And this quantum geometric interpretation pretty much matches what you expect from having these bond dimensions. So the spin network defines the quantum geometry for the 2D triangulation, which is dual to this network. And it turns out that the bond dimension of this network link is actually exactly proportional to the length of the edge, which is caused by the link. And it's precise in the sense that these spin networks really diagonalize the operators measuring these lengths of these edges. So far, I have only introduced these three-valent vertices corresponding to a triangulation. Now it's easy to go to higher valent vertices by just contracting two three-valent vertices, for instance, into four-valent one. Contracting means just forgetting that you have a link between two three-valent vertices and just replacing it with, again, an SU2, this time a four-valent SU2 invariant tensor. So that gives you this tensor or intertwiner, which is indeed characterized just with this virtual spin, J5, so-called virtual spin label. So this would still represent you basically a building block, which is now a quadrangle, but where the length of this diagonal is sharply is sharply peaked on. So you have to actually imagine that this quadrangle is embedded in a 3D space and can, in principle, bend along this diagonal. But since you are peaked on this length, the bending angle is conjugated to this length, and you're completely spread out in this angle if you fix the spin label G5. But we are quantum mechanical, so we can superimpose these states. And in this case, if we superimpose and do it with the right coefficients, we can actually peak on these angles. So the point is that you really get a quantum geometry where you can peak on different quantities for this 2D hypersurface. And you have to imagine that these are quantities describing you the embedding of this 2D hypersurface into the 3D spacetime. So as I explained, the bond dimension of a network link gives you the length of an edge. And so the Rui-Takanagi conjecture basically works with this, that the entanglement between triangles is given by the length of an edge. So if you naively identify the bond dimension with the entanglement, you get basically also this indication of the Rui-Takanagi conjecture. And so here we can formulate this holographic tensor network conjecture. The tensor network states, which come with an interpretation as a regular flat quantum geometry, are good candidates for low energy states for the boundary theory. And well, we will actually see some indication from that, because what we will evaluate is tensor networks which describes this boundary theory. But having this statement, you might wonder about two questions, which is that this choosing this tensor network fixes a particular discretization, and you can ask, what about diffeomorphic symmetry? And that's where I will explain that this choice of bulk tensor network gives you a complete gauge fixing of diffeos. And then you might ask, what are the boundary theories? This will be basically, that's the content of these papers I cited. You will see that for a finite boundary, we get actually an embarrassment of riches. So there's many boundary theories depending on the quantum geometry you choose for the boundary. But for an asymptotic boundary that is asymptotic at infinity, you get signs of universality and the BMS symmetry group. So I mentioned diffeomorphisms, which are a very defined concept in the continuum. So you could ask, what are actually diffeomorphisms in the discrete? And there are two kind of different concepts which turn out to be deeply related. One is a change in triangulation, so in the discretization. And the other is actually a change of edge lengths, which is induced by changing the relative position of vertices. So it's actually that you can really imagine that you shift the position of the vertices. And if you know BF, that it actually corresponds to the shift symmetry in BF. And we will see also here that these both notions are connected. And there's a more general conjecture that the triangulation invariance is equivalent to diffeomorphism invariance for such diffeomorphism invariant systems. So this change in 2D triangulations, we will see, can be interpreted in two different ways. One, we will see that if you change 2D triangulation, that corresponds to an equivalence relation for bulk states. And you might already know them, because it's the same as, again, in string nets. And these equivalence relations just result from the identities for the SU2 invariant tensors. And these do not change the boundary state. So you can make these changes. They do not change the boundary state. See, these changes in the 2D triangulation can be all generated by local changes in the triangulation, which are known as partner moves. On the other hand, a change in 2D triangulation can be actually interpreted as a time evolution, which in gravity is actually diffeomorphism. And more concretely, you can imagine that as gluing tetrahedra on top of the 2D hypersurface and evolving your triangulation in this way. So here is basically the correspondence. You might have seen all these left pictures in just the standard literature. So you have a change in the 2D triangulation, for instance, the 2-2 move that corresponds to this equivalence relation where you replace a part of your tensor network with another connectivity, but you have to take a linear combination with these coefficients, the F symbols, which are just 6J, again, Wigner 6J symbols. And this just corresponds to an identity between for these SC2 invariant tensors. On the other hand, this 2-2 move for the two-dimensional triangulation, you can imagine that one glues a tetrahedron on top of these two triangles and defines a new hypersurface where this one edge now is flipped. The same holds if you take basically one triangle, glue on top of it a tetrahedron, you subdivide it in this 2D picture into three triangles. And again, there is a corresponding equivalence relation here for the string nets. And you might already see that this gluing corresponds, if you do a path integral, it corresponds to associating an amplitude, which is basically given by this F symbol to the tetrahedron, and you glue this to the hypersurface by summing over labels which are shared by the hypersurface and this tetrahedron. A 3-1 move, again, it's in principle an inverse of this 1-3 move, but you can again associate it with a gluing, where you now glue a tetrahedron to three triangles in your triangulation. And these identities all do not change the boundary state. So I've spoken to these triangulation changing moves. So that would be associating diffeomorphisms really to changes in the triangulation. However, you can take certain combinations of these moves which preserve the triangulation. For instance, if you take a 1-3 and then a 2-2 and then a 3-1 move, that corresponds to gluing a complex which is a 3 tetrahedra, and you glue that on top of a vertex, of a 3-valent vertex. It corresponds to an equivalence relation where you basically have the same piece of network, but here you have basically a linear combination. You sum over these spins, which you glue over with a certain amplitude, which is kind of basically given by three of these F symbols. If you glue this complex to the hypersurface, you add basically in the three-dimensional bulk a vertex here, and the inner vertex position, the relative position, which is defined by the length of the edges, the adjacent edges, is actually a gauge degree of freedom, which corresponds to the vertex translations, which give you really the diffeomorphisms. And if you sum over this over these vertex position, that is over the edge length here, that gives you actually a projector, which in this case is a non-proper projector. And again, you know that in the context of string nets, because that's just a Plaquette stabilizer for string nets. And this equation actually represents basically the so-called Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which defines your quantum gravity dynamics in the canonical picture, or the Hamiltonian for quantum gravity, which, since time evolution is a diffeomorphism, is a generator for the diffeomorphisms. So What we have seen is that you can get different representations of one and the same tensor network state, which are related by these diffeomorphisms. And in fact, choosing these and these different representations differ in the spin labels as well as in your network connectivity. So in this sense, choosing a network represents a complete gauge fixing of your diffeomorphisms. Let me come to the second subject here, which is a boundary theory, which you get by time evolving your one-dimensional boundary. That gives you a two-dimensional boundary for which we can also define quantum geometry. And what I just explained is that we do know how to describe these 2D quantum geometries, namely via spin networks. So if you imagine that you have this one-dimensional triangulated circle here, you can glue basically these cylinder pieces on top of that. And a given cylinder piece here just represents the transfer matrix for the spin chain system. So here again, this piece of quite regular triangulation, you can make choices in choosing the length of the diagonal edges. You can take superpositions, and also choosing the length of these vertical edges, where you can also choose superpositions in the spin labels. And that gives you a matrix between the state at a smaller time and the state after one time step. And these choices will then define you the transfer matrix and in principle the Hamiltonian of the theory. You see, however, since you can make all these choices, you do get different transfer matrices for different boundary choices of your boundary quantum geometries. In general, there's basically this embarrassment of riches. There's one example, for instance, if you choose these spin labels here to be one-half spins, so all these G delta are one-half, the diagonals can be something else, and the verticals are also spin one-half, that can be mapped to a six vertex model. And for larger spins, you get a more complicated or richer set of possibilities. So there's many interesting questions here. For instance, you can ask which quantum geometries actually lead to integrable theories. So-called spin network evaluation, which I mentioned, is a subject with quite a long history. So there's quite some literature on interpreting these spin network evaluation as statistical partition functions. I can consult an entire book or some more recent papers where these spin network evaluations are related to the Ising model. So if you stack these one-dimensional transfer matrices or these one-dimensional cylinders on top of each other, you get a longer cylinder, and eventually you can actually identify this cylinder to a torus. And this torus partition functions are particularly interesting to study in the context of quantum gravity. What you would like to know is basically the torus partition function, which you would get by really contracting this tensor network or the spin network on the surface of a torus. And it's quite amazing that there are some situations where one can do that in a either semi-classical approximation, that is in a settle point approximation, And we have done that in this 2001 of these 2017 papers. So one can really evaluate this this tensor network basically analytically. And one what one gets is actually that this partition function reproduces a BMS character plus corrections which describe Transplanckian physics to some degree. These for instance describe a surface of the torus which has a higher winding number, and you can translate it as having a curvature defect in the center of the torus of for instance here 2 pi. And that's consistent with perturbative evaluations, one loop evaluations in the continuum matrix theory, where you also get just you get just this BMS character without this Transplanckian correction, because this Transplanckian corrections really come from using connection formulation, where the connection is can be is exponentiated to a group element, where you don't really see the difference between a 2 pi rotation and a trivial rotation. So this evaluation is a set point evaluation which becomes kind of exact in this limit of large boundary spin. And that gives you this large boundary spin corresponds also in a precise sense to a semi-classical limit. So this BMS character has some peculiar property. It's actually quite singular as a function of the torus moduli parameter. This torus moduli parameter includes a twist, which is before you glue this torus together, you twist one end and by an angle gamma. And it turns out that in the continuum here, this partition function is actually singular for all rational gamma. And so we have seen this BMS character for a particular boundary state, but we have also seen an emergence of universality. And that's in the following sense, if instead of choosing a large triangulation with a large lattice constant, we can also fix the boundary spin and choose a triangulation with lots of triangles. And in this case, we also see if we go to infinitely many triangles, the same kind of singularity structure emerging. Now this singularities can be also regularized if you are actually using, again, a quite different quantum geometry where you take superpositions of your boundary lengths and then you get these nice pictures. So you would have to look at this paper to understand these pictures. And in this case, it's also quite amazing. You can actually exactly evaluate this partition function. So that corresponds to an exact evaluation of this tensor network for an arbitrarily sized tensor networks. And here the boundary states are so special that you can actually exactly evaluate these states, but still see the structure of this BMS character. You can do more things with regard to the boundary theory, which in particular gives you a nice geometric interpretation of your boundary field. And that gives you actually a form of bulk reconstruction. And here the point is that you can apply field redefinitions to the variables you use in your boundary theory. So basically we have seen that we get spin chains or vertex models if we basically use a spin network picture. For the semi-classical boundary geometries, we replace these magnetic indices, which you get in the contraction of your tensor networks, actually with SE2 group variables. And what you get is an SE2 sigma model. You can also do another transformation. They get a rigid solid on solid like models or interaction around the phase models, where you replace again these magnetic indices actually with SU2 representation labels. And the interesting thing is that this SU2 representation label again gives you a length, and this time it's a geodesic, the length of the geodesic going from the boundary to the central axis of the torus. And here these group elements actually tell you the extrinsic curvature that is an embedding angle of the surface in this embedding 3D flat spacetime. So in all these cases, these variables of your boundary field theory actually describe you the embedding of your boundary into your 3D spacetime. And you can also do that in the continuum or in an easier context. And you see that this formulation where you get these rigid solid on solid like models corresponds to a Liouville-like boundary theory. So you do get actually Liouville, the argument that you get Liouville theory in ADS. So here you get also a Liouville-like coupling in the continuum limit. And these considerations generalize actually to De Sitter, ADS, and also a flat sector and 4D. So that finishes part one. I have a much shorter part two, which is more like an appetizer. So here in 2+1D, I basically used a lot that it's a topological theory. In 3+1 gravity, this is not the case anymore. So there have been various models, including various lattice models for 3+1 gravity. And spin forms can be basically understood as a particular lattice model for gravity. It originates from a topological quantum field theory, the same kind of theory we had in 2+1 dimensions, so that's BF theory. But you introduce a non-trivial dynamics basically via lots of defect excitations on top of this topological phase. But what is not well understood or not understood at all is basically what would be the phase diagram of the system. And so that's why I was motivated to look into tensor networks as a tool for quantum gravity. And the context here is that also the 3D models and the 4D models we have are really quantum mechanical partition functions. That is, they are really with an eye and not statistical models. And actually there's a long history of basically failed attempts to construct quantum gravity via Wick rotation as classical partition functions. And there's a number of reasons for that. But one important reason is that the action for gravity turns out to be unbounded from below. So as a statistical model, you are basically always bound to fall into this unbounded well, which you get from this unboundedness. So as I mentioned, even an open question is what would be the phase diagram of these systems? And since we have an eye here, we cannot use Monte Carlo method for simulations. So the idea would be to use tensor networks. And of course, well, the interesting case is really in 3+1 dimensions, so in 4 dimensions. And the spin form models have rather complicated dynamics. So what we started is with lower dimensional analog models, and currently we are in 3 dimensions. And we have developed a number of algorithms for studying basically lattice gauge systems in 2+1 dimensions. To that end, we did introduce a slight generalization of tensor networks called decorated tensor networks, which take into account a certain non-locality you have in gauge theories. And let me just advertise that quite recently we investigated or we defined a tensor network algorithm in the fusion basis. So the fusion basis you might again know from anion systems, but you can also adopt it for lattice gauge theories with abelian, non-abelian, or quantum deformed gauge groups. And if you take this quantum deformation at root of unity, that is for SU2K, the nice thing is here that you get a natural cutoff as compared to SU2 in your degrees of freedom. And you can also actually use it to study a quantum gravity question in 2+1. Also, it's topological. You can basically study what phase transitions between different values of the cosmological constant, which is given by this K level. The fusion basis has an advantage. It has actually coarse graining built in, which is basically in this word fusion. Different from the spin network basis, the structure of the fusion basis is actually preserved under coarse graining, and that's the one advantage of using the fusion basis. So that was just to advertise these tensor network algorithms in higher dimensions. And we are still looking for developing or actually seeing tensor network algorithms in four dimensions. Let me comment on quantum gravity and quantum geometry in four dimensions. So we have seen in three dimensions and 2+1 dimensions, we can interpret the states of quantum gravity as tensor networks. And it has a precise quantum geometric interpretation in the sense that the labels here give us the lengths of the edges of a triangulation. So if you go along the Ui-Takanagi conjecture and use entanglement as a measure for geometries, then in four dimensions, this would suggest that you use areas instead of lengths as more fundamental variables, because the entanglement entropy would scale this area. And then come to that these areas, you know, if you freely assign areas to a triangulation, it does define you something much more general than geometric triangulations. So these need to be constrained in order to define a suitable quantum geometry in four dimensions. So interestingly enough, areas do actually emerge as more fundamental variables also in 3+1. The loop quantum gravity and spin forms, which is basically the provides you with partition functions for 3+1D loop quantum gravity. As I mentioned, the spin form models can be derived from a starting with a topological field theory, the BF action. You add so-called constraints to this BF action, and these constraints have a lot to do with these constraints on the area variables. And here's the kinematics of this framework. It again leads to spin network states. So it's very similar to what we have seen in 2+1 dimensions. And the spins, these representation labels, give you now the areas instead of the lengths, but they're also discrete. So you get actually discrete area eigenvalues. And you can interpret these 3D spin networks as tensor network states for 2D surfaces in the same way as we have seen in 2+1 dimensions. These constraints on these area variables, they change the dynamics from a topological one to a non-topological one, like to the one of 4D gravity, which has propagating degrees of freedom, in particular gravitons. There's something very peculiar emerging here, mainly to having these discrete area eigenvalues. What turns out is that there's an interesting anomaly in the algebra of these constraints. And that, since you would like to impose these constraints, but if you have an anomaly, it's difficult to impose the constraints exactly. So there's a danger that this destroys a suitable semi-classical dynamics. An effect that has been debated for a long time, has been quite unresolved, mainly due to having a very complicated dynamic. So the resulting model of imposing constraints in this topological model gave you quite complicated amplitudes. And what we have recently done is to introduce a much simpler model, which basically captures this key issue of having an anomaly in this constraint algebra. And this is actually numerically accessible, this much simpler model. And we have basically done the first simulations on a small lattice where we have shown that we can recover the semi-classical regime and can reproduce these, can produce these amazing pictures, which you will find in a paper to appear. So we have now a kind of numerical accessible model for 4D quantum gravity. And the plan would be to use tensor networks to investigate the refinement and continuum limit that is a phase diagram defined by these models. So we also know that diffeomorphisms are basically broken, that is generically in models where you have propagating degrees of freedom. So there is not any sense in which you know, you can change tribulations and the physics doesn't change yet. But the hope is that this continuum limit actually restores diffeomorphism symmetry. So let me summarize. So what we have seen is that in 2+1 dimensions and in 3+1 dimensions, there's a precise quantum geometry associated to spin network states. And these spin network states can be taken to define tensor network states for one-dimensional spatial hypersurfaces or two-dimensional surfaces. This quantum geometric interpretation matches well with the framework of reconstructing geometry from entanglement. The entire framework allows you also to find out what is actually the dynamics of your boundary series. It's a holographic dual of your gravity theory. And we have seen that we can reconstruct the symmetry of this boundary theory, the BMS group. There are many issues which are interesting and still to be investigated. For instance, the relation between this boundary quantum geometry and integrability of this boundary theory. For 2+1 dimensional gravity, what we aim to use is tensor network algorithms as a tool to investigate the phase diagram of a truly quantum model. So far, it would be basically the only one on the horizon. And for that, we need 3+1 dimensional algorithms for actually quite involved gauge theories. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the very interesting talk. Do we have any questions from the audience? So please just, yeah, so Leo raised a hand, so please go.
Hi, I have a rather simple question, I guess. At the beginning of your talk, you showed the contraction of 2-3 valent vertices to 1-4 valent vertex. And I didn't understand in which way you need to have in which way this two-dimensional triangulation gets three-dimensional. What do you mean by that?
So you can see the slide?
Yeah.
So it's really that we have this 2D dimensional triangulation, but the state, the quantum state, given by the spin network state, encodes really the embedding of a hypersurface in 3D spacetime. So that is nothing particular to this framework, it's just something which comes out of gravity. So the phase space of gravity describes you the geometry of the hypersurface, but also how this hypersurface is embedded into the higher dimensional space-time. So the spin network states, what I have drawn here, it's a basis state. And in this basis state diagonalizes certain operators, and these operators actually only describe you the so-called intrinsic geometry of the hypersurface given by the edge lengths here. But as well, you can take superpositions of these states, so it's just, you know, more general so-called spin network states. And if you take spin superpositions of these states, particular in J5, instead of the length of this edge, you can peak on the conjugated variable. And I haven't derived it at all, but I'm telling you that the conjugated variable to this edge length is a, angle between these two triangles in the embedding 3D spacetime. So you can construct basically semi-classical states by taking superpositions of these states, which where you would be really peaked in phase space, and the phase space variables would be given, you know, by these edge lengths, but also by these so-called dihedral angles, so that's the angles between the triangles. And these angles would define you how this hypersurface is embedded in 3D spacetime.
Okay, thanks. And is there, so do you need to start with three valent vertices or?
Oh, this is
that your choice?
Yeah, this was just a choice for the presentation. You can have a general, you can speak of general valent spin networks and at once work with these four valent intertwiners. It just, or higher valent so-called intertwiners, which are these tensors. It just said also these higher valent intertwiners, you can always represent them as a linear superposition of these states.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, sure. Okay, thank you.
Okay, do we have any more questions?
Can I make a question on this slide also?
Yeah.
Hi, yeah. I was trying to understand how I can interpret the length as the spin. In a sense, imagine that now I put two triangles or three triangles like in one slice of your partition, of your transfer matrix. And so I would have two spin 1/2. And then I would expect that if I would fuse them to spin one in some way, then I would have doubled the length. But on the other hand, I also know that I could also pick the spin zero sector that would somehow erase the length. So, I don't know if you answered my question.
I understand that. Just that I don't really have a very nice picture to show you. So indeed, if you imagine that, you know, here you see this one triangle, and you can draw another triangle beside it. So then you would get two strands being going in parallel. And you can indeed, in some sense, coarse grain it. And you would get the tensor product. And if you have spin 1/2 here, you would get spin 0 and spin 1. So in some sense, you know, you would rather like to see the spin 1 thing, the spin 1 emerge out of this coarse graining. And indeed, it depends again on your entire state that you really get the spin 1. So it's rather, you know, how do you define the state so that you get spin 1 here?
Okay, thanks.
So it's a bit in this picture where where you actually get exactly spin one if you take the sum over these perturbations, sum over permutations. And that's where everything is built out of spin 1/2 as Penrose kind of envisioned it.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, no more questions. So I would have a very quick question. So when you're discretizing, you probably get free parameters in your theory as well, right? So if you get those, how do you fix them?
So, not in 2+1, of course.
Yeah, I meant in 3+1.
In 2+1, you can choose some, let's say, naive discretization, which might not fix, which might not exactly correspond to the things which come out here. And then, in principle, you would go through this coarse graining program, And you would hope to flow to these topological models because they have endpoints of your renormalization flow. So in 4D, and indeed, there are three parameters. And again, the idea is to use your coarse-graining flow to fix these parameters, and in particular to look for something which is this restoration of diffeomorphism symmetry. And in a simplified context, this has been actually done and shown to work for in a four-dimensional context for kind of a simplified model. So the argument here is that diffeomorphism symmetry, if you want to really look for restoration of diffeomorphism symmetry, that's a very powerful symmetry, actually. It's also a bit annoying because it means that typically you have to solve everything if to know that you have restored diffeomorphism symmetry. But this would fix you really all kinds of kind of discretization ambiguities. And again, we have it has been shown for simplified context and for these four-dimensional gravitational models work by Steinhaus and Barr, but also for one dimensions, you know, just path integrals, you can show that you can restore diffeomorphism symmetry and for interesting one-dimensional models. And the same process fixes all kinds of ambiguities because restoring diffeomorphism symmetry is actually equivalent to going to the continuum and having a continuum theory. So that has been shown in a paper by myself, Barr, and Steinhaus. I think it's from 2011.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Okay,
so... That's why we really are interested in using tensor networks as coarse-graining tools to fix these parameters.
Mm. Okay, yeah, thanks. Okay, are there any more questions?
I have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
So both regarding this diffeomorphism symmetry. So the first question is in the 2+1 case, for instance, in these spin network pictures, is there some nice way to see that if I apply a translation on the boundary, it maps onto a diffeomorphism in the bulk?
Translation, you mean in time or in space?
So a spatial slice, so two dimensions. So you drew this spin network sitting on a spatial hypersurface, right, with some boundary indices?
Yeah. These equivalences, they're really about the bulk diffeomorphisms. Then it depends on how you define the boundary theory. So it turns out that the boundary theory really, you get a non-trivial boundary theory from this topological theory, exactly because you basically break diffeomorphisms normal to the boundary, so diffeomorphisms which would move the boundary by introducing the boundary itself. So that has been shown that has been argued maybe originally by Kaleb, because that also accounts, he hoped, for black hole entropy. Now to your question, you can also consider diffeomorphisms of the boundary itself, which basically just translate the boundary into itself. And in fact, this describes the boundary symmetry group, like the BMS symmetry. And indeed, these connect to a kind of global translation of your entire bulk. There's more to be understood in exactly how this BMS symmetry emerges in this discrete context. So we have shown it on the level of the partition function. But this BMS symmetry is basically something like translations of your boundary. And it's similar, it's actually, this BMS symmetry is a deformation in some sense of the conformal symmetry in the ADS case. I don't know if that answers your question.
So just to clarify, I mean, I was just, I guess my question was just motivated by this naive property from holography that a global symmetry of the boundary gets gauged in the bulk. So if I apply a global translation of the boundary, should I get some kind of a local...
That's exactly the point. So the BMS symmetry is actually, it's a bit surprising that you get it, but the BMS symmetry is a bigger group which includes a rotations times boost, so the Poincaré, in particular the Poincaré translations. And the Poincaré translations, they come from basically taking your entire time slice and translating it. Mm-hmm. And the rotations taking the entire, you know, disk and rotating it, basically. And so, yes, these would be really seen as, in the bulk, as diffeomorphisms, you know, which do not locate to the bulk in some sense, because you translate the entire hypersurface.
All right. Okay. So these are like the large gauge transformations from the point of view.
I mean, large is used in too many contexts, but in this case of boundaries, it's exactly this context. So it's the translations on the boundary are large diffeomorphisms which affect the boundary.
Right. And my second question was: at some point, you made a remark which I may have not heard properly. Is that so? So diffeomorphism symmetry, you made a correspondence between diffeomorphism symmetry and the Plucket operator in the Levenman models. Mm-hmm. Could you just maybe clarify that?
So, diffeomorphism symmetry is actually related to if you don't take a large one, but a more local one, is actually related to translating, you know, changing the position of, say, this vertex. If you see that as a big tetrahedra subdivided in four smaller ones, it's really related to translating the position of this vertex. This vertex translation symmetry, if you go back to BF symmetry, is actually also known as shift symmetry. I don't, I just said mostly, it's maybe some language which you might know or not know. The shift symmetry sets, it's a translation of the B field, which sits in B veg F or BF. And the B field is a Lagrange multiplier enforcing vanishing curvature. So I'm mentioning that because the Plaquette stabilizer for string nets, what it does is imposing exactly vanishing curvature. And again, also, if you look in 2 plus 1 in gravity, it's really the Hamiltonian constraint, which just says that curvature has to be zero. So meaning that if you sum over this vertex translations, what you get is a projector. So it's kind of a averaging over the gauge orbit of the shift symmetry, and that imposes vanishing curvature, and that's exactly the Plaquette operator for string nets. So it's also, you know, you can do it by graphical calculus. You can actually start with Plaquette operator for string nets, which is basically an insertion of a Wilson loop and expand it and come basically to a picture which looks like this one. I can send you the literature if you contact me.
Okay, no, thanks. This clarifies as well. Yeah.
So it's really, I just wanted to point out these many relationships. That, you know, we speak use different names, but it's all something very related things.
Right. Thank you.
Okay, great. So if there are no more questions, then I would say we can stop here. And I would like to thank again both the speakers from the morning session. Thank